Hi, everybody, and welcome to our CLE today, Proactive Medicaid Planning, Leveraging Irrevocable Income and Long-Term, sorry, I can't read, Leveraging Irrevocable Trusts and Long-Term Care Insurance. I'm joined by my friend, Zach Bloxam from Wealth Council, and just a little bit of background of where this particular webinar came from is we did one, I think it was last month with Mark Munson, and we were talking about IRAs and crisis planning, and a lot of the folks that attended that requested this particular webinar. So I had chatted with Zach before about doing it, and so I really do appreciate him being open to be able to do it, and then all of the attendees that kind of forced our hand to actually make this happen. So that's really where that came from. So I really appreciate you all being here. Hopefully we can cover a lot of really good information to help you with your proactive planning cases, whereas we usually focus on crisis planning. Having Zach here to help us through that irrevocable trust, I think will be super, super valuable. But before we get started, for those of you that don't know about Kraus Financial, we are an attorney-led firm that provide asset preservation solutions for estate planning and elder law attorneys and their clients. And we do that by using specialized insurance products, resources, and support to help attorneys streamline the process of advising clients planning for long-term care. We have over 30 years of experience. We have a great team of professionals on staff, and we handle over 400 cases each and every month. Without further ado, I'll introduce Zach. Zach Bloxam is Wealth Council's Elder Law Faculty. That is his title. And Zach helps attorneys and other stakeholders from around the country in navigating the world of public benefits planning consultation. He writes and teaches on areas of Medicaid and VA benefits. And what Zach really brings to the table is that real world experience, because he was a partner in an elder law firm. He knows how to explain these concepts to clients and does an excellent job of conveying that information to attorneys and then also to, you know, his former clients and prospective clients. Anything else you want to say about that, Zach, just kind of your background and where you're coming from?
No, I appreciate that very much. I mean, it's elder law can be very impactful, and it also can be very complex, not just for, you know, clients, potential clients, but for attorneys as well. And so it takes some practice as an attorney to try to make sure you're explaining things and not giving them the entire book of Medicaid, but giving them the important facts, you know, they need to remember. And so I appreciate that, Jim. Same to you. When I was in practice, just a little shout out for Kraus. I mean, we did lots of crisis planning in my firm, and my former firm still does it, still uses Kraus, and it was a great professional relationship that we had in practice. So you're in good hands with Kraus, and all the things they do there are one of the leaders in the industry. So glad to be here, and thanks for the invitation, Jim.
Yeah, thanks so much, Zach. And we're going to turn to Zach in a little bit to go through the different elements of a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust. Is a trademark name the Wealth Council used, but that's the irrevocable trust that attorneys use specifically in this type of proactive elder law planning. And so I'm going to hand the stage over to Zach here in a little bit. But what I want to do first is kind of line up some basic rules so that those clauses make more sense why they're in that irrevocable trust and why this type of planning, proactive planning, is just as important or even more important than crisis planning can be. So I'll go through kind of a little set the stage, a couple slides, and then I'll hand it off to Zach to take over from there. So really, when I started in elder law over 12, 13 years ago now, we were running into estate planners saying, well, my clients aren't worried about this, Jim. This isn't something that my clients are really concerned about. And over the years, that has obviously changed. A lot of the ideas around proactive Medicaid planning have really come to the forefront of clients' mind. And I think this survey comes from KFF, which is the former Kaiser Family Foundation. They did a great survey in 2022. And they found out that 66% of adults 50 or older feel anxious about affording the cost of nursing home or assisted living facility. and less than 50% of those folks actually have any funds in place or a plan in place. So this is where proactive planning and you as the estate planning attorneys really can come and be leaders in your community and presenting these issues to other professionals, but also to your clients and addressing the things that they're really concerned about. And the reason why they're concerned about that is it's almost $10,000 a month now for the cost of a semi-private room in a nursing home in the US. So that's with a roommate, $10,000 a month to get the care they need. And again, just reiterating the fact that most people don't have enough money to pay through the care that they need. So let's make this proactively part of an estate planning plan to meet your clients where they are to help pay for it. Because basically, there's really only three ways to pay for long-term care. There's out-of-pocket, there's long-term care insurance, which we will talk a little bit about having that as an element of your proactive Medicaid plan. And then there's public assistance, which is primarily Medicaid, and then sometimes maybe some Medicare and some VA could pay for some of it. But as you're doing an estate plan with your clients, addressing where do you want that care? How are you going to get that care? Who's going to provide that care? And most importantly, how are you going to pay for that care and integrating that into the estate plan is essential for that estate plan to be successful. Because if your clients are going into that nest egg, taking $10,000 a month, every month, maybe the average stay is 2 or 3 years, those numbers kind of vary that we're looking at, it adds up quickly. That's $200,000, $300,000 that they were planning on funding their estate plan that you've done great work on. Those funds are no longer there because they went to the nursing home, because there wasn't a conversation of how are we going to get you the care you need and pay for it, and what mechanism are we going to use to pay for those, to pay for that care. So just really, really important, I think, to include it in your estate planning and making that a proactive part of all your estate planning and having those conversations with your clients. So we talked about there's kind of three ways to pay for it. There's paying out of your pocket, there is long-term care insurance, and there's Medicaid. So we're going to hit on Medicaid really quickly and some of the rules around Medicaid before I hand it off to Zach, because understanding some of these rules will make the trust construction make a whole lot more sense. So Medicaid is a joint federal and state program that covers health-related costs and individuals with limited income and resources. So basically, Medicaid is going to be the program that will help pay for a extended stay in a nursing home. And it really is the only federal state program that's out there to help pay for that nursing home level of care. And each state does have its own unique regulations. We're going to focus on some federal regulations because even recently with the irrevocable trust, when states have tried to create greater restrictions than what we'll talk about, the federal courts have come in and said, no, you can't do that. Most recently in Minnesota and Montana, the courts have really come down and said, no, you really need to follow those federal rules. States, you can't go outside and make them more restrictive than what the federal statutes allow. And so that's really where these trusts have been tested, is in federal court when states have tried to add in additional regulations that aren't in the federal code. So let's talk a little bit about the financial requirements. And again, this isn't going to be an extended lecture on Medicaid qualification, but there are a couple what I'll call foundational rules that we need to cover really quickly so that trust construction makes more sense down the road. And the first one is that when someone qualifies for Medicaid benefits, long-term care Medicaid benefits, their income minus a few deductions is going to be their Medicaid copay. What that means is any income that they're receiving is going to end up at the nursing home minus a few deductions. So a lot of times what we're thinking about in trust construction here is how are we going to create an income right? And we want to increase income in retirement. Well, when we're thinking about Medicaid as the potential payor of long-term care, we might not want to increase income because of this foundational rule. If we're helping someone get qualified for Medicaid benefits, that income is going to end up going to the nursing home, which was probably not the thinking when that idea was set up to increase income for retirement. So being able to think about planning into this rule, if we know that Medicaid is going to be the plan down the road, can be very, very helpful when we're thinking about proactive Medicaid planning. And obviously, with crisis planning, we're using a lot of the income rules differently than we are in proactive planning. But I did want to highlight that that rule, the institutionalized person's income minus a few deductions, the personal needs allowance, insurance, and any monthly maintenance needs allowance diversion is going to go to the nursing home. So we might want to be careful when we're thinking about income and trust planning. Zach's going to talk a little bit more about that. So let's talk about assets, the asset side of the equation. The individual resource allowance in most states is $2,000. There are some exceptions, the biggest one being since 2024, California, which no longer has an asset limit. And you can see the various other exemptions there, exceptions to the $2,000 rule, with Connecticut being below the $2,000, and then other states have been increasing their individual resource allowance, Michigan being the most recent, who took theirs from $2,000 up to $9,660, which gives folks a little bit more of a wiggle room when they're thinking about Medicaid qualification planning. The community spouse, remember, can have more assets than an individual. The community spouse can keep what's called the community spouse resource allowance, and the maximum CSRA that someone can achieve is $157,920. So again, when we're thinking about proactively planning for Medicaid qualification with a couple, that's kind of that number that we want to be thinking about. If we need to get them qualified for Medicaid down the road, we need to get their assets down below the individual resource allowance and the CSRA before they can qualify for Medicaid benefits. So how are we going to do that eventually down the road when we're thinking about proactive planning? Because you can't just give away assets when it's time to qualify for Medicaid. If we could, that would make life a lot easier, but this is called a divestment, and that would cover any gifts made, transfers to an irrevocable trust fall within these rules, and also selling assets for less than fair market value. But kind of in our topic today, any transfers you make to the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust would be considered a divestment and then would impose a penalty period. And so what we really want to focus on when we're thinking about proactive planning is the, we call it the look back period, but in this context, we're going to think about it almost as a look ahead period, where the state Medicaid agency basically has 60 months from the time of the Medicaid application to look back into the client's business and see if any transfers have been made. And in our context for the course today, that would include any transfers to the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust. So what we want to do, the goal with this type of planning, is make the transfers and then wait 5 years, because then when the client submits a Medicaid application, there'll be a question on there that says, have you made any transfers for less than fair market value in the last 60 months? Client can check no, those transfers were made further out than the 60 months. So that is not, those transfers will no longer be considered by Medicaid because they're outside of the five-year look back. And when we're actually sitting down with a client, what we're trying to figure out is this client going to make it through the next 5 years? And we make transfers into a trust so those won't be penalized. Another reason why Medicaid Asset Protection Trust planning is so important is because of estate recovery. The federal government requires states to have an estate recovery plan in place to recoup the costs of funds expended on Medicaid recipients. Now, how aggressive states can be is really dependent on their own rules. So some states will say, well, we're only going to go after assets that are in that person's probate estate. So that being the case, we could use a due on death deed, a revocable living trust in those states that have it in the Lady Bird deed, and maybe a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust isn't necessarily needed. However, other states, we call those the expanded estate recovery states, have expanded their rules. And I'm going to read the language here because it is so expanded, I guess there's not a better word for it. To include any property that the Medicaid recipient had an interest in at the time of death, which can include claims against property held by a life estate, revocable trust, transfer on death deeds, et cetera. So if you're in an expanded estate recovery state who has a very aggressive estate recovery agency, a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust might be the only way to protect those assets should the client get qualified for Medicaid, receive benefits. The state's going to come after anything that they had an interest in at the time of death and really chase that down, even if the asset has already transferred to a beneficiary on a deed, for example. The Medicaid Asset Protection Trust might be the only way to provide complete protection against estate recovery if you're in one of those expanded and aggressive states. Zach did a great, great webinar for us on this attorney access platform called Can Medicaid Take Your Client's House? So he goes into that, goes into the all the states' different rules, how they approach it. So I would encourage you, those of you that are attorney access subscribers and you have, if you have questions about estate recovery and how your state approaches it, Zach did a great job for us. And I'm sure if you're a Wealth Council member, that's also on the Wealth Council platform as well. So what is the strategy when we're talking about proactive planning? So what we're doing, using those rules that we learned, we have to work within those rules. So what we want to do is we want to talk to the client and figure out which assets make the most sense to protect. And we have to move them kind of off the table. So the thing, what we'll do is we'll transfer assets that we determine make sense to be protected, and Zach's going to talk a lot about that, and complete the basic traditional estate planning with remaining assets outside the trust. So we're not going to move everything the client owns into a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust. We're going to move those assets that we think make the most sense to be protected. Most attorneys that do this type of planning generally start with the home and then work from there. Okay, the home is the most valuable asset. We want to keep this home. I was talking to an attorney who had a client who's, I think it was a seventh generation farm that they have kept in the family, and they wanted to use one of these trusts to do that and keep that piece of property that means a lot to that family in the trust, but also make Medicaid an available potential payor of long-term care should they need it down the road. And then I would recommend also talking to the clients about purchasing a long-term care insurance policy to go along with that planning strategy. That's going to be your safety net. Let's say somebody doesn't make it through the 5 years. We can trigger those policies, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And then if and when that insurance benefits run out, after 5 years from the date of the transfer of assets to the trust, at that point, like I mentioned earlier, the client can then apply for Medicaid benefits. Their countable assets will be lower, and they'll be protected from estate recovery when they pass away should they receive those benefits. So it kind of serves as that dual role of lowering countable assets while also protecting assets from estate recovery. And there's lots of other reasons that we'll talk about why we use irrevocable trust. But that's kind of the overarching umbrella of a proactive planning strategy. So let's talk a little bit about the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust, and then Zach will take over and talk about the different clauses within that trust. So the reason why we use an irrevocable trust, we kind of covered this probably ad nauseum, kind of beat this down, but it also is not just any old irrevocable trust. This is a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust that was specifically designed to protect assets from estate recovery and remove them from being countable resources. When we used to teach this, we used to talk about how this is probably the most unsexy irrevocable trust you'll ever run into. It was written for a specific purpose, and that was specifically designed for Medicaid planning. So it doesn't have all the fancy bells and whistles that some of the other irrevocable trusts have that we use in estate planning. Instead, it's really straightforward. It's going to have some different restrictions in it to comply with the Medicaid rules. And then the one question I always get when I'm talking to attorneys about irrevocable trust planning is they say, well, my clients just want to make the gift to the child. And so I listed some of the reasons why using an irrevocable trust might be a better option than just a straight gift to a child. And the first is beneficial tax treatment. And Zach's going to talk about that. The other thing that we can do using an irrevocable trust is the protection of asset in the trust from the creditors of the children. So if we were to just make a transfer of, let's say, the home and then some liquid assets to the children and then wait 5 years to apply, well, those assets are now subject to their creditors. They're subject to their habits, be gambling, maybe they have the drug issues, or maybe they're going through maybe a business divorce or a couple's divorce, a marital divorce, always subject to the nuances in that family because those assets are now theirs. And so using an irrevocable trust creates more protection while the grantor is still alive, and then Zach will talk about naming death beneficiaries, and when the person passes away, then we can either keep those assets in trust or make those distributions outright. And then I think another one that's important is you're creating a fiduciary duty with a trustee. So you're not just handing assets over to a kid. They can do with them whatever they want, because now they're those assets. Instead, we're creating a fiduciary duty to the beneficiaries, where the trustee has to act in their best interest. And so hopefully you get somebody who's taking that seriously. They're protecting those assets and they're managing the assets accordingly per the rules. And so I think it's a much better option than just giving away those assets to the children, because again, we don't know what's going to happen with those. And just a reminder that again, that once we make those, once we take the title of those assets, we move the ownership over into the irrevocable trust, that is a divestment that would trigger a penalty period. So we want to wait the 5 years before we get through that. And if you have a married couple, because Medicaid counts assets as kind of a marital unit, is the best way I've come to explain it, is that if either spouse applies for benefits prior to the five-year look-back period, the penalty will be imposed regardless of who is the title owner on the property. And as a former real estate attorney, this kind of boggled my mind for a long time when I was trying to figure that out. But just know, if you're working with a married couple, you want to make sure that you wait 5 years for either of them to apply, because they'll get that penalty period regardless of who was actually the title on the property that was transferred into the irrevocable trust. And just a reminder, there's no limit on how long the penalty period can run. So if you're moving a valuable home, let's say, into an irrevocable trust, and I did a case at our debrief where I think they got like 700 months or something. It was a payout of a claim from a personal injury claim, and it was in the millions of dollars, and they got this really big penalty period. So remember that. So why do we use an irrevocable trust specifically, and why does it have to be so restrictive? It's again because of the federal statutes. And basically what the federal statute states, that if there's any circumstances under which the individual can receive benefits, they'll be considered available assets to the individual and countable. So we have to pass what's called the any circumstances test to make sure that the grantor and the grantor's spouse has no access to the principal. Otherwise, the principal would be counted for Medicaid purposes. And I think this case really summed up the any circumstance test as well as any had out of Massachusetts. And it states that the effect of the any circumstance test is that if the trustee is afforded even a peppercorn of discretion to make payment of principal to the applicant, or if the trust allows such payment based on certain conditions, then the entire amount that the applicant can receive under any state of affairs is the amount counted for Medicaid eligibility. This is why this trust is not full of backdoors, bells and whistles, trapdoors, whatever you want to call them. It's a very straightforward trust that makes sure that the grantor is limited. And so with that, Zach, I will hand it off to you to kind of walk through the construction of this trust for folks, and I'll let you take it away from here. You just let me know if I lollygag too long on any of these slides.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Jim, and thanks for that great introduction and some baseline information about Medicaid, and particularly what the purpose of the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust is. So as that Fournier case mentioned, kind of that peppercorn of discretion, that's probably the first thing to think about is, when we talk about discretionary authority within the trust for the trustee, you have to assume that any trustee discretion that is provided is going to be used against the grantor to the maximum extent possible within the document. And so some of the language in some of the HELP federal guidelines are that if there are any circumstances, even if it's remote, they're going to be used as if they were exercised by the trustee. And so that is kind of a different thing when we talk about discretionary authority within a trust. In a lot of situations, that's okay for public benefits, but for purposes of Medicaid, that trustee authority is going to be deemed against and against the grantor to the maximum extent possible. And so the first step in the MAPT is to ensure that the grantor does not have access to principal. And the statute's very clear in that it separates principal and income. It refers to both in the any circumstances test. But there really isn't no differences between the states on how principal is treated. And so this is one of those blanket rules where the grantor and the grantor spouse cannot be beneficiaries of principal of the trust either directly or indirectly. Now, you can think about it directly. You can kind of understand how that would be the case. I've had throughout my time in practice and as I worked at Wealth Council, I've seen trusts, reviewed trusts that have been irrevocable trusts that have been designed for the purposes of Medicaid planning. And it will come in and it's the Jones Irrevocable Trust. I'm like, all right, we're looking good here. See, mom and dad put the house in the trust 6 years ago. Okay, it's been more than 5 years. And you look inside page two and page three of the trust and you see that mom and dad are principal beneficiaries. And you'll say, yes, that's an irrevocable trust, but it's not going to be Medicaid compliant. It's going to be a countable resource. Additionally, they may have a situation where if a certain asset is sold, then it's distributed to the grantors. Now, that's not a, you know, they don't beneficial interest right now, but if that home can be sold, and it can be under the discretion of the trustee, then Medicaid is going to treat that as if it was sold and distributed to the grantor and to be used for their payment of their care. More difficult to I guess, prevent, and why Jim mentioned that maybe the map's not as, it doesn't have as many bells and whistles, is because the indirect access to principal can be difficult to prevent, because there's lots of different ways in which Medicaid agencies have strived to pierce Medicaid planning trusts and get them to be countable for indirect purposes. So, for example, if a trustee has the authority to allocate between income and principal, that's an authority that's a lot of times a boilerplate authority within most trusts. If that's in a Medicaid trust, that's not going to be allowing the trust to pass muster, because the trustee then has the ability to allocate between principal and income. And if that's the case, they could get that principal back to the grantor. And that's what we don't want. Additionally, if the trustee has authorities to potentially utilize assets or leverage assets in a certain way, and there isn't a restriction against their ability to get back to the grantor, that can also run afoul. And so the direct access is probably something we can protect against, but the indirect access is something that through the years that the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust has been being used by practitioners throughout the country, we've kind of seen where agencies have tried to pierce and where they have not. And so we'll talk a little bit about this as we move forward, but most of the cases that go up on review are for indirect access to the grantor for principal purposes. That's where they shoot for it. When we're talking about right to reside, we're talking about powers of appointment within the trust that we use for basis adjustment, grantor trust status that we try to get because we want to provide good tax ramifications for the grantors. All of these things are kind of the add-ons inside the trust that Medicaid has said, this has nothing to do with Medicaid, but we're going to try to make this trust countable because we want to make sure that if it is countable, that we deny that ability. Turning to income, income is a little bit more tricky because, as the statute said, it does distinguish between principal and income. And so you'll find different states have different rules in terms of grantor access to income. The general rule within the MAP is that we want to restrict the grantor from being an income beneficiary because that income beneficiary status, let's say if there's an asset within the trust, let's say it's a home, for example, and the grantor is now in the nursing home. If the grantor has an income right in that home, there are court cases in Massachusetts, Montana, and elsewhere that have stated that if the grantor has an income beneficiary, then the market value of what a rental rate could potentially be imputed back to the grantor, which is not what we want, because if that's imputed back to the grantor, then their share of cost is going to increase at the facility by whatever the value of that rental rate was. So we don't want necessarily income beneficiary status. That can be difficult sometimes with clients who want to retain the right to receive rental income and stuff like that. And that's okay. In certain situations, you might be okay with that in your state. I know certain states that the Medicaid offices have a very good understanding of the distinction between principal and income. But I would say generally most states don't do that. So the general rule is that we don't want the client to have access to income either. And it's not just for eligibility purposes for income. It could potentially be for purposes of estate recovery in the at the end, because if we have a map that we've drafted, and let's say it's gone the five-year clock, mom's went on Medicaid for quite some time, there was no income ever generated from the trust, but she's an income beneficiary, then the estate recovery claim comes in, and they review the trust, and they see that mom is an income beneficiary of the trust. You're going to have a difficult time trying to argue to estate recovery why they shouldn't be able to recover from the match. Whereas if they weren't a principal beneficiary and they weren't an income beneficiary, you're on a good posture in terms of defense for estate recovery. Now, this isn't to be confused with making the trust intentionally defective for purposes of income tax. So we are okay with them being an income obligator, but not necessarily an income beneficiary, if that makes sense. Okay, we can go to the next slide. And that kind of touches with this grantor trust status. So this is one of those add-on benefits that we have strived to provide in the map that are a good, better, best scenario for Medicaid. Because if you just had a trust that was irrevocable and it met the any circumstances test and that was it, that might be a good outcome for someone who wants to protect the value from Medicaid. But if you were to lose a lot of the tax benefits, both on an income base and on a capital gains base, and when we talk about basis adjustment, if you were to lose all of those benefits, then I don't know if it would be the best strategy. And so we've gone through this, and courts have looked and reviewed these with magnifying glass, because what we're doing here is we're making the trust intentionally defective for purposes of income so that we can have the grantor be treated as the owner for trust property and income, so we can keep those tax rates low on income and capital gains. And if the grantors want to sell a home during their time while they're alive, that they can still take advantage of the IRC 121 exclusion of gain. Many times the clients that I meet and I in my practice and the attorneys that I help clients with now, they're doing the five-year plan, and the idea is that we still want to have the ability to sell the property. Can we do that? Can we sell it and downsize it? And the answer is yes, because once it's transferred into the MAT, we retain grantor trust status, and if we need to sell that home and downsize, we don't have to restart the five-year clock, because the asset would have been transferred into the MAP, sold from the MAP, the new home would have been purchased from the MAP. We have now, instead of an asset with just the MAP as a home, now we have the MAP owning a home and some cash in the bank account, and we don't have another five-year clock. So grantor trust status is super, super helpful and beneficial as an add-on to Medicaid planning. And additionally, inside the MAP, we give two different powers, the power to substitute assets of equivalent value and the power to add charitable beneficiaries. And these are just options within the IRC grantor trust rules that we allow individual practitioners to decide on which power they'd like to choose. I would say most practitioners I know, and I know I did this, I thought that the power to add charitable beneficiaries was probably the more conservative approach, but we haven't really seen any negative outcomes with the power to substitute assets of equivalent value as of late. I think it's kind of understood that the grantor trust status is in available use. But with power to add charitable beneficiaries or the power to substitute assets of equivalent value, we're just needing the ability to have this as an available power. We don't necessarily exercise it. It's just the ability to ensure we can trigger grantor trust status, because grantor trust status is triggered with only, you only really need one thing inside the trust to trigger grantor trust status, and you need to avoid all of the grantor trust rules to avoid it. And so most chances you're going to have information inside your trust that's going to trigger it, but we actually want to expressly and explicitly trigger grantor trust status because it's such an important part of the MAP drafting. Additionally, when we talk about basis adjustment, we have a lot of assets that clients want to convey into the MAP that are heavily appreciated, the home being one of them, but it could be an investment account, could be anything that has been heavily appreciated. If we were to just transfer that asset into a trust and lose the ability to potentially get a basis adjustment on that, then it would be a bad situation for the client. And Jim mentioned this, and I saw it lots in my practice, and this example kind of points to that. Mom bought a house a long time ago, pennies on the dollar nowadays, right? 100 grand, and now it's worth a lot more than that. And mom has one daughter, and mom loves this daughter. It's her only child, and she doesn't see really the necessity in her mind from utilizing a trust instrument, whereas just gifting it outright to the daughter. what she doesn't know is she does gift that outright to the daughter. The daughter is not, is in many, in most cases, going to sell that property. She's not going to stay in it. So it's not just a matter of if she's going to sell it, it's when she's going to sell it. And the issue is that when she sells it, she's going to have a major capital gain because she's had a gift and now she's being not being able to receive that adjusted basis. If we utilize the MAPT, mom transfers the home into the trust and the daughter is the only beneficiary of this home. When mom passes away, we're going to be able to get a basis adjustment. There's not going to be a tax ramifications for the daughter. And mom wouldn't want that either. So sometimes people say, well, I'm going to be dead when that time comes. And you're like, well, would you like to have your kid have to pay six figures of your money that they're not going to be able to use to the government? And you know, I would say in almost every situation, like, no, I don't want that. Okay, that makes sense. I guess I probably need to be thinking about more than just my own debt. So the basis adjustment is a huge thing. And I mentioned it in my earlier comments, the basis adjustment, grantor trust status, these are things that Medicaid offices have tried to say, well, if you're trying to get this benefit, then we're going to consider that indirect access. And they have been unsuccessful in doing that so far. So we knock on wood, but they've tried some really good arguments and they failed in some of the highest courts around the country. And we hope that that will continue because the retention of the limited power of appointment that we utilize within the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust is very, very unique in terms of how it's used. And when sometimes people think of the limited power of appointment, they assume, well, there's no estate planning rules are you have a limited power of appointment, you don't get a basis adjustment. Those two things don't usually connect. But we're not using that phrase of limited testament, limited power of appointment in the phrase that most estate planning attorneys use, 2041. We're talking about it in a different context, 2038. And the grantor in this case simply just needs to maintain some level of control to get those assets back into her estate for estate planning purposes. And so the limited power of appointment is limited in terms of who can have it and to the extent of people who can be benefited from the power of appointment. We had a situation in one of the cases where there was a retention of a limited power of appointment, and the power of appointment was allowed to be appointed to any charitable organization. That's what the language said. Mom went into the nursing home, and she was at a nursing home that was, you guessed it, owned by a charity. So now we have a situation where we have a potential problem, and the Medicaid office made a very good argument to say, hey, mom is in a facility that's owned by a charity. She has a limited power of appointment here that allows her to be able to appoint to charitable entities. That means that she could indirectly benefit from the use of a limited power of appointment to the benefit of the charitable organization that owns a nursing home. Talk about the worst fact pattern you could possibly think of, right? I mean, the attorney who probably got that email was like, are you kidding me? How did that happen? But the court did a very good job of kind of identifying what the actual issue was, and state law, as well as just commonplace in terms of limited power of appointment, black letter law is that these can't benefit the individual. You can't use a power of appointment to benefit yourself. And that's what state law said. And that's what the trust said as well. The trust said you can't use the power of appointment to benefit yourself. And so the court said, yeah, they could use a charitable organization, but that organization cannot be someone that would benefit the client. The four corners of the document said that that's a restriction. So the restrictive power of the limited power of appointment actually was to the betterment of the client by outlining that. In fact, so much so that if you go on in Massachusetts, which is a lot of people say it's very aggressive in terms of the way they use Medicaid, I actually quite like the way Massachusetts does it because they understand the rules and they actually provide good resources to attorneys. If you search Massachusetts Health or Limited Power of Appointment Medicaid, they have a really nice little fact pattern here, and they say, here's limited power of appointments that we will be okay with, and if they have to meet all of these criteria. And it's based on a lot of the court rules that have been said. And so that's a lot of the resources that we get from Wealth Council and from others to try to make sure our trusts are following what the lay of the land is. Because a lot of these courts, whether in Massachusetts, Montana, Nevada, Minnesota, Texas, they are all kind of talking to each other because these areas can be complex and they cheat off each other's homework. And so what one court does, the other court just basically says, the Massachusetts court said this, and this is what we're saying too, which is good because we have good case law now, so we actually like that momentum. in terms of the benefit to the client. So as we talk about like the fiduciary responsibilities inside the trust, the trustee is obviously going to be a very, very important part. And I think Jim was well said to say that one of the benefits of the trust in lieu of just outright gifting is the ability to just impose a fiduciary duty to someone to manage the money inside. That being said, because the MAT generally does not allow the grantor to service the trustee, because we don't want the ability for Medicaid to see that they're controlling over trust property. Because if you have a grantor who's also the trustee, you not only have to worry about indirect access from the grantor, now you have to worry about trustee powers that could potentially be utilized to benefit the grantor. If they're the same person and the grantor is both the grantor and the trustee, you have two different offices now you have to protect against indirect access, not just one. So the grantor should not serve as a trustee unless you are 100% sure your state allows that. Now, there are some states, I think Wisconsin and a few different ones, that you allow the grantor to be the trustee. And there's really nothing in federal law that would prevent them from doing that. There's nothing in the statute that would prevent them from doing that. But on erring on the side of caution, the general is that we don't want the grantor to serve as trustee. The best case scenario is to have an independent third party to serve, and be kind of the non-emotional, good fiduciary steward of what's the MAP needs to do. But that's kind of a wish. And I say 90% or more of the MAPs that I drafted in my practice, it was an interested trustee, one of the kids. And the reason why is that because we're not allowing the grantor to be the trustee, we are necessarily inviting a third party into a very, very intimate legal document, right? And so most of the time, the grantors are only going to feel comfortable with that, having someone that they know really, really well, and that's typically going to be one of the kids. But that trustee is going to be able to manage the trust. They're going to be able to follow what the trust says and to make sure that they are following the language in a way that's will not run afoul of the Medicaid rules. In fact, some of the language inside of the trust can actually prevent and protect the grantor from even the trustee doing things they shouldn't do. There's a case, pretty recent case, where the trustee had actually got a denial for a Medicaid. The nursing home said, we're gonna evict you out of here if you don't, give us our money. And the trustee got scared and actually took out money from the trust and directly gave it to the nursing home, which is obviously a no-no, right? You can't do something that's going to just benefit mom. And the court said the trustee wasn't supposed to do that. We're not going to hold mom accountable for that because the trustee violated their own duties in doing that. The four corners of the document said you're not allowed to do that, which is a good outcome because the Medicaid office obviously wouldn't have seen it that way. They're going to like, oh, we told you could get it out. We told you get it out and you get it back to mom. We knew that was going to happen. But in that case where they actually got it back to mom and benefited mom, the court said it was the trustee's fault. It wasn't mom's fault. We're not going to blame mom. Lifetime beneficiaries, on the other hand, can sometimes be the same people as the trustees because if they're interested, that kind of makes sense. Grantor gets the ability to name the lifetime beneficiaries. They can receive distributions of income, principal, or both during the grantor's lifetime. And then depending on the standard for distribution within the trustee just needs to maintain and ensure that distributions are made only to those lifetime beneficiaries that the trust allows. Now, this is an important concept to discuss with clients about because sometimes they hear the word irrevocable trust and they think, that's it, lock and key, never seeing this again. And that's true. You're never going to be able to get that money back directly. But because of the use of the lifetime beneficiaries, we can go from the trustee can make distributions to the lifetime beneficiaries. And then at that point, the lifetime beneficiaries can do whatever they want with the money. If it's their money at that point, there's nothing in the trust that would obligate them to help mom and dad. But at that point, if they've made a distribution from their own inheritance and wanting to discuss and assist mom, that's something that clients do often. Trust protector. So a trust protector is an important facet inside the trust in that it allows some kind of independent party to come in and ensure that trust's assets, and that the language of the trust is accomplishing the tasks that the client wants. Now, whether the attorneys serve in this role or not is really a matter of preference. Some attorneys like to just be named as a trust protector designator, where they designate someone to be the trust protector. But think of the trust protector as coming in and saying, if there's something in the trust that's just not working correctly, either because we had some agency said they didn't like a piece of language, or maybe there was no trustee that was involved, or maybe there was an amendment that needed to be made, a scrivener's error, or something that's just not allowing the trust to function fully. We don't want that, obviously, to be the grantor, right? The grantor is not going to have this power. But we want to have an independent party to come in and potentially be able to update the trust. And this can be very helpful to kind of say, look, we have kind of a backstop to this. And for Medicaid purposes, as long as that person's independent, it shouldn't really affect the grantor's ability to maintain the five-year clock, because the grantor is not making a change. There may just be something inside of the document that needs to be updated. Now, funding the trust, we talk about the five-year clock. So the home can be exempt, as we mentioned, from countable assets when they're qualifying, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that exempt asset can be transferred. And so sometimes people think, well, the house is an exempt asset, so even if I'm in a crisis, I can do a MAP, right? And MAPs can be used for crisis planning, particularly with the use of Medicaid-compliant annuities, which you at Crouse know a lot about, but not necessarily for the purposes of the house. And the reason why is because just because it's exempt doesn't mean that it is allowed to be transferred. And so think about it this way. A transfer to a MAP is a sanctionable transfer, and that's a good thing, because the whole purpose of a sanctionable transfer means that it's not countable anymore, right? So if someone says, well, I transferred it to my MAP 3 years ago and Medicaid's saying it's a transfer of assets, that's a good thing. Not the good thing that you're within the five-year clock, but that's a good thing that they're treating it as a transfer of assets, because that means that they're considering the trust as passive in any circumstances test, that it's not countable. And so thinking that it's just always about it's okay to say we want to make a divestment, like Jim mentioned. Divesting is what the purpose of the MAP is. And so we're going to transfer the home into the trust, and we're going to do that for many different reasons. We're going to try to start that five-year clock, right? And Jim already mentioned the protections potentially against, creditors, and there's sophisticated stands for elder abuse and stuff like that. We want to try to provide protections against that go beyond the time our clients are in our office. And with estate recovery purposes, it's important to know that estate recovery is very, very, it changes. It's very changing. So think about it this way. Just since I started working for Wealth Council, we've had states who have become more robust and gone to an expanded recovery jurisdiction. And we've had ones that have said, you know what, I don't know so much. I think we're going to maybe rein this in and go back to more of a limited recovery jurisdiction. And you can't guarantee to your client what your state's administrative and statutory regime will be when they pass away. You just can't do it. And so sometimes folks in limited recovery jurisdictions say, well, I don't really need to do this. And I said, well, you're right. Right now, it may not be necessary. But if you've seen where a lot of the federal discussion is on cuts to funding, where is it usually rested? A lot of it comes from the Medicaid department, right? If federal Medicaid funding is cut or in some ways curtailed, state funding will need to do the same. And if that means that they have to have less money for more and more people who are going to be on the rolls, they're going to find the states trying to find ways they can make more revenue. And estate recovery is going to be where it's going to be at. So one of the collateral, I think, consequences to changes in the Medicaid rules that you've seen maybe talked about in budgetary federal level will spill down to states. And my guess would be that it may lead to more expansive or more aggressive estate recovery mechanisms. Now, when you fund the home into the trust, you transfer it by deed. And you have to understand that there are going to be some things that you aren't going to be able to fully promise your clients. When you're relying on federal authority for tax basis, for capital gains, even for Garne St. Germain, if the home has a mortgage on it, which allows you to transfer a home into a MAP even with an existing mortgage, pretty confident and very confident that you're going to get good outcomes using federal authority. The difference between property tax exemptions is they're almost county by county based. And so we try to do our best with the grantor trust status to ensure that we can get that, but it isn't always the case. So that's one area where you may need to consider just having an additional discussion with the clients. And then you properly carve out what benefits your client is going to be using. I had a client, I had an attorney say, so on my map, do I just write in there that it's a life estate? And I said, absolutely not. You don't do that, because the life estate actually has a value, right? And so if estate recovery comes about in the future, they're going to be able to attach that life estate value to your trust because you just gave up that argument. You just said it was a life estate. When we talk about right to reside or the right to occupy, we're not talking about a life estate. We're talking about something less than that. We're not talking about something that has a Medicaid value. We kind of want to have our cake and eat it too, but you don't want to give away the argument by just flat out expressly saying it's a life estate. But we also want to retain any benefits that we can to our clients. And states that have fought the right to reside and said that's an indirect benefit, it should be principal, should be counted, they've lost. All the Medicaid offices who have tried that have lost. And so the right to reside can be retained potentially for initial and continuing eligibility. And I think it puts you on a good path even on the estate recovery side, because it's not up to the limit of a life estate. And it's certainly better than leaving it in their name, which would be subject to the full recovery value. And then lastly, I think we have a slide on the death beneficiaries. So beneficiaries at the grantor's death, they can be completely separate from those of lifetime beneficiaries. Many times they're the same, but this is where the grantor's ideas are going to be the same, whether they go on Medicaid or whether they're not, right? The hope is that the use of a map does not necessarily follow 5 years down the road entry into the nursing home of Medicaid. The hope is that that doesn't happen. And if you could guarantee to your clients that you had done some legal insurance using the map to protect the value of the home and any other assets placed in there, and they never needed Medicaid coverage, that's still a good investment to them, even if they never need to go on Medicaid. And so I found that a lot of my discussions with my potential clients who were in their 50s, they weren't thinking about long-term care. So it's a very good time for you to talk about, well, we need to do an estate plan of some kind, and we have this ability to utilize the map to protect some of these assets. We don't have to put all your assets in here, but what can we do to protect maybe your most valuable assets? So if you did need long-term care, we wouldn't have to have it be subject to eligibility rules and subject to a spend down, which allows you to then be able to complement the map with what Jim's going to talk about next, the long-term care insurance, because those kinds of legal insurance and the financial insurance that go with long-term care, that's really when the client's in the best situation, because they've basically provided protections and insurance against whatever may come. And if it never happens, that's what insurance is for. You didn't think, oh, I shouldn't have really had life insurance those years I was raising my kids. I never used it. That was a terrible decision. No one thinks like that, because they're saying, I saw what the risk was. I paid X amount, and now I, even if I didn't need to claim on the policy, it was still a good financial decision for me to make. So with that, Jim, I'll pass it back off to you to close out with the long-term care insurance discussion, and stay around if we have any questions at the end.
Yeah, thanks so much, Zach. That there's a lot in there. I think you teach that over the course of a day and a half at the immersion camp that Wealth Council does. So thanks so much for covering that in such a condensed yet thorough manner. I really appreciate it. I'm going to talk about long-term care insurance very quickly. We have a lot of resources on long-term care insurance on the Attorney Access platform, but I just want to fold it in so that as you're thinking about this irrevocable trust planning, where can long-term care insurance come in? Because to Zach's point, the ideal age to get a long-term care insurance policy is much younger than your clients are probably seeing you for crisis planning. So the sweet spot for getting a long-term care insurance policy is between the ages of 50 and 65. And the reason why it's so a powerful product is you can use your long-term care insurance for at-home care, also at assisted living facilities, and receiving different types of care. So getting homemaking, chore services, adult daycare, things outside of the nursing home, because Medicaid is limited to services within the nursing home. There are some home and community-based services programs. They vary greatly state to state. They're perpetually underfunded. So using a long-term care insurance policy, coupling that with your proactive planning, to Zach's point, you're writing off a risk. And that risk is you're not going to have a way to pay for long-term care insurance. You're going to have to spend down all of your assets, and you're going to end up on Medicaid and maybe get those taken away. So covering yourself or your clients with a map to protect those assets and with insurance to help pay for the cost of those and maybe never go on Medicaid can be the ideal circumstance. So I have a couple slides just on different types of long-term care insurance. Again, we have a lot of these resources on the website. Traditional long-term care insurance is like your basic insurance policy, like automobile or a life insurance policy, like Zach mentioned. You can use it. If you don't use it, then you lose those premiums unless you get what's called a refund of premium on your insurance policy that will refund your premium amount minus any claims or a percentage of that to your beneficiaries when you pass away. I always think it's good to see what the average premium costs and benefits are because everyone says, well, it's too expensive and I can't get qualified for it. So I shared some average premiums and then the benefits that most folks get with that average issue age being between 55 and 64. If you do have traditional and a partnership program, it will exempt resources if you use that policy, and it can exempt assets in the same amount of that policy through a state recovery, but that does vary state to state and does have to have some specific policy requirements. And if you're looking at this with your clients, please feel free to give us a call. We're more than happy to help you out in reading some of these traditional policies. This is just some language that you might want to be looking for in your state Medicaid manual. This is from Colorado, where I'm at. Has a nice example here at the last paragraph. For example, if you receive $20,000 in insurance benefits from your partnership policy, you generally will be able to retain $200,000 of assets above and beyond the amount of assets normally permitted for Medicaid eligibility. Likewise, Medicaid would disregard up to $200,000 of the same assets in your estate at the time of death, which then can be passed on to your chosen beneficiary. So a traditional partnership long-term care insurance policy can increase those minimums while also protecting more of those assets. Obviously, they're outside of the trust from estate recovery as well. So it kind of serves a dual purpose there. Then we have the hybrid long-term care insurance policy. Generally, this is a life insurance or an annuity contract with the ability to access the death benefit funds if there is a long-term care need down the future. And that's usually done through a life insurance policy with an acceleration of death benefits rider or with a separate long-term care rider. And the way that that usually works is if the benefits are received for long-term care, the policy provides the greater of the remaining death benefit or the amount specified by the residual death benefit. And this was just an example from a policy that I pulled that guaranteed at least 10% of that life insurance death benefit of the face amount was still available even if you used all of the long-term care insurance in that policy. So there can still be a remainder benefit with those policies. And again, we have lots and lots of resources as part of that. But I did want to get to an example that I had thought of that I think it was helpful for me to kind of put all these pieces together before we get to questions. So I use Jerry as an example here. He's 65. He's in good health, has a family history of dementia, and recently was a caretaker for his parents. So he's coming into your office thinking about this stuff. He doesn't want his kids to have to worry about his care and should he have a similar diagnosis. He wants to do proactive Medicaid planning, and he owns a home, has an active life insurance policy, and $300,000 in liquid resources. So his goal is to leave a legacy for his kids while ensuring they're not responsible for his cost of care. So you look at that life insurance policy, and what you can do with those is convert the policy into a hybrid policy using what's called a 1035 exchange, and then add in the long-term care amount or the long-term care rider to be able to access those funds before he passes away. So he uses that policy to fund a hybrid policy and adds $100,000 to increase the benefit on that policy. And then you work with Jerry and you decide that transferring $100,000 and his home makes the most sense to go into the trust. Fast forward 2 years, Jerry is diagnosed with Alzheimer's, but his doctor thinks he can slow the cognitive decline with medication, diet, exercise to extend his life expectancy. So we're looking at a longer life expectancy even with this diagnosis. So the first thing he does, and this is what I think is key with long-term care insurance, is you can trigger those benefits before needing that nursing home care. So he triggers that policy to get a caretaker to come into his home, as well as homemaker support, because remember, his goal was he didn't want to have that burden onto his kids. And so he uses that policy until those benefits are exhausted after 3 years, and then everyone decides it's probably best for his safety and care to move into a nursing home. And now that 5 years has passed. So he does some crisis planning, he does some spend down planning with his remaining assets, applies for Medicaid benefits, gets immediate eligibility for Medicaid while protecting his home and the $100,000 that was in the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust. And those will also be protected from estate recovery. Let's say that he's receiving Medicaid benefits for an extended amount of time while he's in the nursing home. Those assets are protected from estate recovery. So that's how you can combine the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust planning maybe with a long-term care insurance policy and make sure that you've protected what you can protect against and guarantee as a risk aversion that the client might have. You can come up with a plan for that and also make sure that Jerry's getting the care that he needs. So I know we went through the long-term care insurance part quickly, but we will take more time on May 20th going through a booklet that we have, and we'll call that one Breaking Down Case Studies Every Attorney Should Know, and we'll have that ability there. And then we also have, again, a lot of long-term care insurance webinars on demand as well, both in our basic, our free platform as well. As for our subscribers, we have a little bit more access to long-term care insurance information, and that is a service that we do provide here at Crouse Financial. And again, you can see those on our attorney access platform. But before I let Zach go, please let me know if you all have any questions. And of course, Angela asked me an insurance question that I don't know the answer to. For a 1035 exchange, she asked, is it limited to whole life policies for conversions? Angela, I'm not sure, but I will get you that information and I'll email it over to you. Any other questions for Zach before we let him go on his way? Zach, I can't thank you enough. Thanks so much again for providing your insights using the Wealth Council knowledge. Again, that's a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust. That's the irrevocable trust that has become the standard in the industry for those types of planning opportunities. Full disclosure, I sold that for about 10 years, so I'm a little biased, but I also know the good folks that keep that up to date. So if you are looking to get access to that, please reach out to Wealth Council and they can get you the membership options there. I'm not seeing any other questions. So again, please join us for further benefits. Again, Zach, thank you so much for your time and effort here today, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Jim. Appreciate you having me, and good luck to everyone in your practices.
Thanks, everybody.